Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So now we do have some time for questions before lunch. And once again, if you could stand up and say your name. And for anyone who's viewing from afar, if you push the button on your machine, you can send in. Yes, right here.
Hi, it's Zoe Matthews again, Friends, Families and Travellers and trustee of National Voices. It was good to hear Steve talk about challenging some of the bigger institutions. We've been working to bridge gypsies and travellers into services for a long time, and there's a lot of us here who are bridging people into services, but what we need to do now is to change the service delivery. The resources are fewer, so we're actually trying to sort of funnel people through with less resources. So we've got to change the methods of sort of service delivery. And actually, for us, that means sort of tackling some of the big institutions, the British Medical Association, the Royal College of GPs, because I think we need to embed the kind of inclusion health model into the training. You know, what we find is we can go and do some cultural awareness training with some individuals in GP surgeries, and we can change the hearts and minds of some people, but it's not embedded. You know, these are powerful institutions that do have and have had a vested interest in maintaining, you know, their positions. And I think if we really want to make a difference, we've got to start getting them to think differently.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Hello, my name is Riyad Akbar. I'm from Tower Hamlets Council. My background is housing rather than health. And my question is to Freek, if I pronounce that correctly. You did mention some of the divergent policies of health and homelessness. In terms of the way that EU nationals are treated, EU migrants, who may have lost their worker status. We know that a lot of homeless rough sleepers particularly suffer from substance misuse are probably not going to be counted as workers. There is a different approach between health and housing in the services that they're offered. They're often outside the scope of housing, but will often be entitled to some forms of health treatment. Just wondered from your experience of other countries in Europe, which countries are doing well in working together to address this? I work in London, rough sleeping is a big problem, and the largest group of rough sleepers in London is from the European Union.
Maybe first to say that it's not a big issue in many countries. It's a big issue in the UK, in the Netherlands, in Denmark, to some extent in France. In some other countries, it might be an issue related specifically to the Roma population and the Roma moving across Europe. But the problems you have with homeless Polish and people from Baltic states is not so widespread. So it's not amongst the 27 countries that I have to tell you who are doing best. But maybe also first of all to say it is indeed a bit, I think there is a flaw in EU policy, in EU legislation at the moment. There is a difference between a health emergency and a social emergency. In most countries, I mean all countries actually, and it's regulated by EU law, also for these people that lose their worker status, there's always a legal access and legally enforceable access to emergency healthcare. In some circumstances, other problems which are not directly related to health, like access to emergency social care, like shelter, can be as lethal as urgency health problems, but there is absolutely no EU legislation. So it means that it's perfectly legal for countries, if you put it into an EU legal context, to not or to deny access to emergency shelter for EU citizens that have lost their worker status. And some countries have actually done that. I mean, they have adopted legislation that does that. Denmark, for instance, formally excludes EU citizens that are not workers from emergency hostel provision, and that's very strange. I think in terms of solutions, there is two solutions to it. Or you work with these people to provide them a job, and then they become a worker, and then they can access their rights again. Or you work towards a reconnection with the country of origin. And there is some countries that are very good in working with these people to provide them a job and reconnect them with the job market. Sweden, for instance, has very interesting projects in that sense. But in terms of reconnecting with the country of origin, I'm not aware of any really good and sustainable solution. I know there is some work done with organizations, with NGOs in the countries of origin, but I'm not convinced that it's the most sustainable and most high quality work that could be done. So especially in that area, in the reconnection area, I think there is room for improvement, and we're willing as Fianza to take that up.
Sorry, we have a question from one of our viewers.
We have two questions from our online viewers. The first is from Shane Bradley in Ireland. You say in Finland they have or will close all shelters by 2015. This, I presume, is one aspect of their approach. Can you say a bit more about what services they are putting their resources into instead, and is extra money being put forward for the transition period? Second question is from Carol Murphy in Dublin. Do you believe the housing first model is a cost-effective approach as opposed to shelters with in-house services, e.g. housing an entrenched homeless individual, actively using drugs and alcohol with multiple physical and health needs, minimal life skills, is expected to maintain a tenancy with visiting supports? Surely this requires a large multidisciplinary team available to visit this individual very regularly. Huge costs.
So in Finland, it's obviously more than just providing access to housing. It's the support element that requires most attention, and there is a lot of money in Finland going into providing social and health support. Also money into innovation to allow experiments, innovations in that area. So obviously it's more than just housing, but I can only say there is lots of reports also on Fianza's website on how the Finnish housing first approach works, and you will see. I mean, one of the things that you have to know about Finland is the pure housing first model, as it has been invented by Sam Tsimbelis in New York, I think, is very pure about scattered housing. So people, homeless people, are put into individual apartments that are scattered throughout the city. While in Finland they have that as well, but they also have communal housing. So it's not an institution. I mean, people have a rental contract like anybody else, and they provide support, but they are living together and they're doing some activities together. So I think they probably adapted a bit the housing first, the pure housing first model from the US to the reality. And so there is some kind of communal housing first with communal social and health support, but certainly not only about housing. In terms of whether housing first is cost effective or not, it depends what population group you're talking about. A lot of the research evidence that comes from the US and Canada is about the most entrenched homeless people, rough sleepers with mental health and addiction problems, which are costly to society when there is no proper policy for them. And the evidence from the US is that for these people, providing housing and if necessary, very intensive social and health support is still cheaper than keeping the old staircase model where people pass through different temporary living forms before they enter into housing. There's, by the way, an Australian research, more of a longitudinal research, where they followed a cohort of homeless people, which comes to the same conclusion that it's actually cost effective. Of course, for the people that are less costly on society in the current system, the cost-benefit argument works less well, and that's, of course, an ethical problem, so that's why we have to be careful not to just focus on the cost saving from Housing First, but also the actual improvement of the well-being and the housing stability of the people.
Any other, yes? Oh, I'm sorry, there's one of, excuse me, there's two of them. Okay.
Thank you. Jill Brown from Brighter Future Stoke on Trent. I'm really interested in what people are saying about Housing First. And I've been working with homeless people for 25 years and suddenly realised that when that person's been thrown out of the hostel for the 15th time, they're giving you a bit of a message about how appropriate hostels are for accommodating them. And in our experience, Housing First works with the most entrenched rough sleepers who have complex needs or multiple disadvantage. They're the people for whom Housing First works really well. I don't think it's an expensive model. I don't think it's any more difficult to do. If you run hostels, it's a bit of a scary thought, and I run those as well. But I think we've got a cohort for people here, and I think it's early days. We're finding it successful. What we find is one of the key tipping points for getting entrenched people who are entrenched in their rough sleeping back on the streets is to get our community matron out on outreach with our team to engage with them. We talk about homelessness and the health of homeless people, and I'm wondering whether there is a paradigm that actually another way of looking at this that says there are untreated health conditions which lead to people becoming homeless. And once you can begin to get people to engage with health services, i.e. provide the right sort of health services, we've seen stunning outcomes in people's attendances at A&E disappearing from 90 a year to none, but actually getting people who have been homeless for a long, long time into settled housing.
I'm Angela Burnett from the Greenhouse Practice and Freedom from Torture. I wanted to thank all three speakers for great talks. And I wanted to sort of link things from all three of you. I think Jimmy's exhortation, never give up on anyone, I think is so important. And then I wanted to link that with what Steve said about people who are hard to reach. And again, this thing of blaming people. I now don't talk about people who are hard to reach. I talk about people who are easy to exclude. And I think it's the responsibility of service providers not to exclude people and never give up on anyone. And I wanted to link that with the importance of homeless people themselves being engaged in decision making and providing services, and really in the centre of things rather than on the periphery, really. And to say that we have just started quite recently peer mentoring in partnership with Groundswell, and it is just fantastic the difference it's made in enabling people to access services. So thank you.
Is this on? If I could say something, I think there is a theme that links together, and the more I go out to places like Oxford or Leeds, the common thread is that there's much more integration around the human. So I think we should be commissioning different sorts of services to what are happening now in our cities. I don't think there's much pushback from national organisations like the BMA or the colleges in medicine. It's what happens on the ground from a contracting point of view, because most of the medical services have been there on and off since 1946 and going back into the start of the 20th century in different forms. So how do you break out a contract when patients are money? That, you know, when if you sign on a series of patients, they bring in money into a practice. On the other hand, the most vulnerable use more of the resources up generally. So I think One of the things we've got to move away from is that you can have the same sort of service everywhere and it costs the same. Because the common thing between Oxford and Leeds is that the funders, the commissioners, want to reduce the costs. Yet they're only looking at the cost per head for medical care. If you look at the benefit to society and you link in housing and social care, if you put more money up front, they actually get people back into productive lives. You take, this as Pathway have done, you look at the number of reattendances in emergency rooms and it's reduced. The length of bed stay in hospitals is reduced. So you put more money in to places like York Street and Luther Street and you save money. So I think we need to have a different form of commissioning, but we also need different forms of providers, which include charities, local government with housing and social care, as well as health and secondary care, and join it all up together. And what we need to do is create a bit of a movement for change, but the resistance is always local.
Thank you, Steve. I think at this point I should be kind and say that lunch is available now in the foyer and we need to be back here at 2 o'clock. But let me just say a very wonderful thank you to Jimmy and to Freek and to Steve for a really stimulating time, and to all of you for paying attention all morning. And now it's time to relax. Okay. See you at 2.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.